From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Schools are starting to open around the country, and at the same time, some parents are wondering if their children's schools will be forced to close because of swine flu. Well, the answer, according to many school administrators, is probably not. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, new health guidelines put more of the burden on parents to keep sick kids at home.
Last spring was a nightmare for school districts in places like Fort Worth, Texas. After just a handful of cases of swine flu cropped up, Superintendent Melody Johnson was told by local health officials to send 80,000 students home.
We were told shut down 4 days. No, you have to keep closed 7 days. Then it was 10 days.
The system stayed closed for 6 days before the policy changed. New federal guidelines recommend closing schools only in extreme cases. The big push this year is focused on parents. Last April, Superintendent Belinda Puska had to close the Schertz-Cibolo School District in South Texas. This year, she's sending out this message to her families.
Just assume that your child will have the flu at some point this year. What kind of arrangements will you make in order to make sure that your son or daughter is taken care of?
Puska says it's not always easy to get parents to keep kids home if their illness appears mild, but health guidelines say students should remain at home for 24 hours after they no longer have signs of a fever, and that means without the use of fever-reducing medication. Belinda Puska says it may be even harder to convince parents whose alarm about pandemic H1N1 has eased somewhat, but she tells them this.
Take other people into consideration. There will be a child in the classroom who either has asthma or is medically fragile, or a teacher who may be pregnant.
Those are all risk factors that can lead to complications. And that creates a challenge for the many schools that deal with medically fragile students who have to be protected. Dr. Corey Hebert is chief medical officer for New Orleans Recovery School District, which is already back in session.
Especially the children that are coming back from recess, they're sweating, they're dirty, they're not washing their hands, you know, that type of thing. We're definitely keeping our susceptible populations away from them.
The new guidelines also recommend that kids who get sick at school be isolated until parents pick them up. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also suggests that if swine flu or the regular flu virus appears, schools should divide students into smaller groups or increase the space between desks. Those may not be realistic options for the many districts that are overcrowded. But Belinda Puska of the Schertz-Cibolo Schools in Texas says despite a lack of space, she has devised ways of reducing the chance of infection.
What we're saying this year, we're not going to have group supplies. Every child will have their own supplies, and we're going to keep them separate so that you don't have as many opportunities to spread germs.
Many educators privately questioned the CDC policy last spring. Some said their students probably face greater risks from the outside world since they get their only balanced meal at school and end up on the street. But if health officials say they should close, schools have little choice. A number of schools say this year they will play a more active role in stopping swine flu by offering children and staff the vaccine once it becomes available. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Americans debating health care can do comparison shopping with other nations. We heard this week about Britain's system, and this morning we go to Spain. Its health care system has been ranked as one of the best in the world by the World Health Organization. As Jerome Sokolowski reports, most taxpayers there don't seem to mind paying for it.
La Paz University Hospital in northern Madrid is not known for its creature comforts. But most patients say they're not bothered by the hard plastic chairs or the absence of soothing music in the waiting rooms. La Paz might be one of the oldest and biggest hospitals in Spain, but it's considered one of the best.
Hola, buenos días. Buenos días.
Celi Abelleira has come for a follow-up appointment. She had a kidney transplant 5 months ago. I feel like a new person, she tells her doctor. Before the operation, Abelleira said she hardly ever set foot in a public health facility. She was one of the minority, the 10% of people in this country who pay extra to be treated at privately run clinics. But when symptoms of kidney disease developed a few years ago, Abelleira headed straight to this public hospital. The doctors are excellent, the nurses are very nice, and the service has been really good, she says. Out in the waiting room, another kidney recipient, 32-year-old Jorge Oria, is not quite as enthusiastic. The care is good, technically speaking, but the personal service has its ups and downs, he says. The most common complaint of patients is the long wait to see specialists and undergo certain procedures. On the other hand, a study published last year in the U.S. journal Health Affairs found that in Spain there are a third fewer deaths caused by delayed access to health care than in the United States. Spain's constitution, drawn up in 1978 following the Franco dictatorship, not only guarantees the right to universal health care, it also requires the state to provide it. The World Health Organization's ranking system puts Spain's healthcare system 7th in the world, well ahead of America, even though it spends much less on healthcare. Dr. Jimenez says the system covers virtually every medical need. I don't know of anyone who's had to go to another country for treatment that doesn't exist in Spain, he says. There are thousands of primary care clinics, even in small villages. Patients have a choice of doctors they can see as often as they like, and there are no copayments and no claims forms. Even undocumented immigrants are treated. In Spain, no one worries about their health coverage. If someone loses a job, is short of money, or needs long-term care, the system will look after them. For those Americans who are used to private doctors offering a plethora of tests and the latest technologies, the Spanish system might seem a little basic. But no one is turned away. Life expectancy in Spain is one of Europe's highest, and many of family practitioner Jerónimo Fernández Torrente's patients in the northwestern city of Lugo are over 80 years old. He says there's no question of rationing. People come complaining of osteoarthritis or that they are 90 years old and their cholesterol is a bit too high, and you have to refer them for treatment, he says, because the system guarantees it. Torrente is also vice president of the main Spanish Doctors Association, the OMC. He complains that physicians here are underpaid and overworked. Still, he defends Spain's medical service and insists it has nothing to do with socialism. It's the humanization of medicine, he says. As a citizen, it's my obligation to make sure that everyone has basic health coverage. But while healthcare costs are rising fast, Spanish politicians don't dare limit coverage. On the contrary, one of the most surefire vote-getters for both left and right is the promise to build new hospitals using taxpayers' money. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolovsky in Madrid.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now a story about the recession and an industry long thought to be recession-proof, Hollywood. Well, no more. At the center of this story is a movie, The Maiden Heist. It's a comedy starring three Oscar winners, Morgan Freeman, Christopher Walken, Marcia Gay Harden, and one Oscar nominee, William H. Macy. The movie's wrapped and ready for theaters. There's just one problem. You can't see it. NPR's Corey Turner explains.
The Maiden Heist is a love story trapped in the body of a caper. Freeman, Walken, and Macy play security guards who have worked in the same art museum for so long that they've fallen in love with the art. When the museum announces that it's suddenly shipping much of its permanent exhibit to Denmark, the three men conspire to steal their favorite pieces. Here they are, practicing their rappelling skills for the big break-in.
You sure about this?
Of course I'm sure.
Let her rip, soldier.
Okay. Good luck, Roger.
Okay, here goes. Yeah.
Roger, you okay?
I'm not sure.
That's Christopher Walken, dangling off the side of Freeman's apartment building. Stuck. The film is now similarly stuck, or, as William H. Macy puts it,
we're waiting for a miracle now.
The Maiden Heist was financed by Bob Yari, the money man behind a handful of modest box office successes, including Crash, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Yari got tired of depending on the big studio distributors to put his offbeat movies into theaters, so he created his own distribution unit, which was set to release The Maiden Heist last fall. The shoot went well, no last-minute rewrites, the movie wrapped without incident, and headed to the editing room. But in June of last year, 2008, producer Rob Paris noticed something wasn't quite right. Though the movie was set to hit theaters in November, there had not been any talks with Yari about how the movie would be marketed.
You usually start to have those conversations. You start working on your poster ideas, your TV spots, and there was nothing. And so we thought, you know, each month went by, we started getting more and more nervous.
Paris says it was 2 months later, in August, that he was told Yari's distribution company had hit a hiccup. The money Yari had set aside for what's known as P&A, for prints and advertising, had dried up. Bob Yari.
The bigger funds, hedge funds and other funds like that, they were investing in independent film P&A. Kind of overnight, they went away.
They went away because the U.S., along with much of the rest of the world, had found itself in the middle of the worst recession in decades. The Maiden Heist had cost just under $20 million to make, and Bob Yari believed it would take at least that much to market the film. William H. Macy.
If you spend a little bit of money, you get nothing for it. You're kind of stuck. You've got to do a big campaign in order to get lucky.
A movie that hits theaters without marketing is like the proverbial tree that falls in the woods. It's still a movie, even if no one shows up to watch it, but it's also a financial disaster for everyone involved. Yari tried everything to raise the ad money.
Even putting the company up for acquisition or partial acquisition, and even financing our library of films.
But Yari found no takers, and his distribution company was forced into bankruptcy. That left few options to save The Maiden Heist. Among them, go back to the big studio distributors. There was just one problem. Yari had already sold the DVD and pay TV rights for The Maiden Heist to Sony. And according to Yari, that's a problem because...
The general rule of thumb is you're not going to make your money back theatrically unless you have a runaway hit.
You make your money back when the movie lands on DVD and cable. And no studio wants to put a movie in theaters without that ancillary safety net. As for Sony, it owned the DVD and pay TV rights, but to a movie that had no marketing or theatrical distribution. If the studio had agreed to pick up the tab, it would have been taking on even more risk. But that didn't keep Yari, Paris, and Macy from asking. Sony's response, according to Paris, was firm.
It's water under the bridge. We've taken the loss already. We don't really care to reopen this very painful chapter.
I reached out to Sony for its side of the story, but was told the company had nothing to say on the matter of The Maiden Heist.
I haven't been compelled to throw my head into the oven yet. Now, that doesn't mean I won't.
Producer Rob Paris.
I guess if I had to frame one person for this heist, it would be Bernie Madoff. There you go. There's the villain. There's the CEOs. It's the CEOs that took down The Maiden Heist. There you go. Now that's a third act.
William H. Macy is hoping for a different third act.
This film ain't dead.
And he's right. Even if The Maiden Heist never makes it to a theater, it will likely land on DVD and TV someday. Sony wouldn't say when, but when it does, says Macy...
You can never tell. It just could tickle people's fancies, and it'll fly off the shelves.
Speaking of shelves, there's a moment in The Maiden Heist when you realize that if their caper succeeds, the three museum guards will have their beloved artwork all to themselves. No one but them will ever see those pieces again. In much the same way, The Maiden Heist now sits on a shelf, much loved by a few, but waiting for an audience that may never come. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Even if you can't see The Maiden Heist, you can watch a few scenes from the movie. They're at our website, thenewnpr.org.
Even before the recession, some companies were struggling with the notion that many of their customers expected to get their products for free. That's a trend in marketing and pricing, and something customers have come to expect, especially in the digital world. So for the next 3 days, we're going to examine how free is changing how companies do business. The free world. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has our first report.
When you emerge from the elevator and step inside the offices of Teach Street, the gaggle of software engineers and casual atmosphere remind you of a dot-com era startup. But the business model here is decidedly 2009. The company is an online marketplace for teachers and students, and TeachStreet founder and CEO Dave Chappelle says free is part of its marketing strategy.
So if you teach piano, you can come to TeachStreet, add your profile, and a listing that says that you teach piano. That's free. It's likely always going to be free.
Some of the firm's services have a price tag, but Chappelle believes that in order to get people to use his site, it has to be free, at least initially.
Free takes away risk.
Deborah Mitchell of the business school at the University of Wisconsin says human beings try to minimize risk. It's something our brains do, though we might not even know it's happening. What's more, she says, in many instances, especially in the digital world, we've come to expect a price of zero.
You know, the so-called Google generation, or people under the age of 30, certainly under the age of 20, have grown up having all kinds of access to things online that didn't cost anything. So they expect music, other kinds of content, news. You know, even in the industry of pornography, they feel like the content should be free.
In the online world, some things cost very little. In his new book, Free, the Future of a Radical Price, Chris Anderson explains the logic behind an old assertion that some information wants to be free.
Digital stuff, this is bits, have unique characteristics. They can be copied at almost no price. They can be distributed at almost no price. And these unique properties of bits carried with them economic implications. And one of them is that they could be made free. And therefore, because they could be made free, that there was a sort of gravitational force for them to tend to become free.
Not everyone agrees with this thesis, but it's fair to say that when most people think about getting things for free on the web, what they really mean is they don't pay any money. The cost is often shifted from users to advertisers. Google makes a bundle with this model, but many other companies haven't. It may surprise you to learn, for example, that so far, neither Facebook nor YouTube has turned a profit.
You're right that YouTube's not profitable today.
But Anderson says it will be soon.
This is the thing about new companies, is they tend not to make money in the early years. What you build is you build non-monetary assets. You build audiences. You build attention. You build content. You build data. You build something of value. And then you figure out what the business model is.
But once something's been offered for free, it's hard to get people to pay. Just ask newspapers who are struggling to find ways to make money from online content that's now available for nothing. Some marketing experts, including Peter Fader of the Wharton School, suggest that this move to free has been too fast and too dramatic.
It's created this impression that we must go in the direction of free, and that could be harmful. It could become a very dangerous self-fulfilling prophecy. There's still many areas of digital content where people are quite willing to pay and don't need any notion of free at all.
Author Chris Anderson views things a bit differently. He says in many instances, companies can find a way to make more from giving things away than from charging for them. Just about everyone in the digital world lets you try a free sample. Some companies hope that what they offer is so valuable that people will pay for it. Other firms are turning to what's called a freemium model. Give most things away, but charge some people for a premium product. In theory, at least, those who pay will subsidize everyone else. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
Tomorrow we'll examine how two companies are learning to adapt, coexist, and compete in the free world.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Hundreds of electric companies are offering the chance to buy green power. The utilities are touting energy from renewable sources, such as wind or solar. But do you know what exactly you'd be buying? For our series, How Green Is It?, NPR's Elizabeth Shogren decided to find out.
David Bell is an architect in Washington, D.C. He's turned an old townhouse into his office with all kinds of environmentally friendly technologies, like a self-charging automatic water faucet.
It has a little turbine inside. It's a little hydroelectric plant right here.
So when an entrepreneur offered him a chance to buy clean electricity and cut his power bills, Bell signed up. But is that what he's really getting?
Do you know where the power comes from that actually powers your lights and the other electrical appliances here?
No.
Is it green power?
I've been told it is, yes.
Not exactly. Turns out the electrons that power the lights and air conditioning in Bell's office still come primarily from old-fashioned coal-fired power plants. So what is the clean power that Bell and so many other consumers are being sold?
Well, it's termed green power.
I asked Gary Skolnick, the entrepreneur who sells electricity to Bell.
It doesn't mean that the actual electrons are coming from a wind farm thousands of miles directly to this particular business.
A lot of people buying clean energy think that's exactly what they're getting. And if you listen to pitches from power companies, you can't blame them.
Now, if my calculations are correct, signing up for Pure Power means I can prevent over 18,500 pounds of greenhouse gas from entering the atmosphere.
Now that is pure genius.
But listen carefully to advertisements like this one from a company called Ameren UE in St. Louis. And it's a lot more complicated.
When you enroll in Pure Power, Ameren UE purchases renewable energy certificates equal to 100% of your electric usage. That means more reliance on renewable sources such as wind power and less on fossil fuels.
Plus, did you catch that part about renewable energy certificates? For each unit of power a wind farm sells, it can also sell a renewable energy certificate. In other words, customers aren't actually buying electricity from windmills. Their dollars are subsidizing renewable energy to encourage power companies and other businesses to build more windmills and solar plants. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Energy Department promote these programs. Gary Skolnick says it's a way to replace dirty power sources with cleaner ones and fight global warming.
It's like taking a glass of water and adding green food coloring to it. You're greening up the power.
Some researchers, like Michael Gillenwater at Princeton University, think this is all a bit of a shell game.
You would think that total amount of investment they're making is all going to build new wind turbines that would not have been there anyway. And that's not true. They're causing probably a little bit of new generation and new investment.
He says the payoff is pretty small. Customers aren't cutting greenhouse gases nearly as much as they think.
If I buy 10 megawatt hours worth of green power certificates, maybe I've caused one extra megawatt hour to be generated because of a new wind turbine was built. But nine of those were just there anyway because of government tax incentives and other things.
So is there any way you can go out and buy real, actual windmill-generated power?
I'm quite frustrated by the current situation.
David Wright tried to for the city of Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's on the local energy panel there that wanted to buy wind power. But there's only one utility in the area, and all it's selling is coal and nuclear power coupled with those renewable energy certificates.
A certificate is not a renewable energy purchase. For the utility and for others to make those claims, I think it's highly misleading.
If you want to know for sure that the power you're using comes from a windmill, about the only option right now is to put one in your backyard. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
And you can find the other stories from our series, How Green Is It?, at npr.org.